Welcome to the Eric Scott Show on WASR. It is 12:02, and if you were listening to WASR just a little while ago, you may have heard him on the Jack Keith Show, which we are proud to air here every weekday. It's Senator Jeb Bradley, Mr. Majority Leader. Good afternoon, sir.
Good afternoon, Eric. How are you?
I am very well. It looks like a nice but cold weekend. Is that good hiking weather when it's cold like that?
It should be pretty good, actually.
Oh, okay. You planning?
I don't
on
think
getting
it's going to be that cold, but maybe above tree line. I haven't looked that carefully yet, so I'm hoping to get out. Oh. We'll see.
Well, I hope you can. I do want to start with continuing some of the one of the subjects that you had talked about on Jack's show, because I got to admit it confuses the hell out of me. This whole thing with the impeachment in Washington. He's no longer the president, and we know that you need a two-thirds majority in the Senate to convict, and I have a better chance of hitting Powerball. So the $64,000 question I have, Senator, is why are they doing this? This is theater. That's all it works out to. Or is that all it's supposed to be?
That's a pretty good question. I mean, there was some discussion a few days ago that there might be, because the former Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell had indicated when he was still Majority Leader before the switchover to Senator Schumer, McConnell had indicated he, hadn't decided how he'd vote on impeachment. And so then the question mark became, okay, are there potentially 17 Republicans that would join him? And there were a few names mentioned, but with McConnell potentially being on the fence, the speculation was that, they'd get to 67. It would appear, in listening to the news and seeing Senator Lindsey Graham on the news last night, that they've taken a nose count and the Republicans are not going to vote to impeach the president. And if I were there, that's how I would vote too, not to impeach. I just think it is, it's time to move on. And it's, as I said, a little while ago when you were simulcasting, I think our nation is better served by focusing on getting more people vaccinated as quickly as possible, protecting the public health, getting, the economy back on track, helping small businesses that are really between a rock and a hard place, and people that, need to get back to work. I think that would be a much better focus than, spending weeks, which is what it would take, to conduct another impeachment trial. Just remember, it was about this time, a year ago in 2020 that, the Senate was having a trial, and it took all the oxygen out of the room for 2 or 3 weeks. And I think in the middle of a pandemic, time to move on. And as I said before, if President Biden wants to do something to try to unify the country, that would be a unifying move.
Yeah,
it seems that Speaker Pelosi is very interested in that, though.
Well, and it's funny because the Speaker, as you know, has not done whatever she's supposed to do with the Articles of Impeachment, formally given to the Senate for right.
They have to. They have to deliver the Articles of Impeachment to the Senate. And if you recall, a year ago, she held on to those articles for, a couple of weeks, maybe even, before they were delivered.
Right. Yeah, I remember that.
I don't remember why, but it was pretty telling because it just seemed to heighten the politicization of impeachment, which, I think right now it's time to stop throwing gasoline on the fire, reduce the partisan divides, focus on, what the country needs to focus on. And there's a very real question the way the Constitution is written, if you can even impeach somebody once they've left office. So,
right.
And some, I think most legal scholars feel that you can't, but, you know,
well,
anyway.
Let me ask this. Even if they did convict him, which, like I said, I have a better chance of hitting Powerball, what are they going to do to him? He's not the president.
It would be nothing more than a scarlet letter at this point. I mean, so.
I think he's done enough of that on his own.
And again, I think, and I agree with those who are calling for, you know, a bipartisan commission to look at what happened
mm-hmm.
on January 6th to, you know, make some determinations as to who knew what when and how many people were involved and, you know, who they were. And obviously the 200 or 300 or whatever it was, people that stormed the Capitol. I mean, that's totally unacceptable, as I've said many times since then. And, you know, they should be prosecuted to the fullest extent of the law. But I think a commission would be able to at least attempt to get to the bottom of it. And we'd probably have a little bit more information. And I think more information would help answer some of the questions that have been raised. And, you know, even more important, do a better job of preventing it in the future.
So like the 9/11 commission.
Exactly.
Okay. It is 12:09 here in WASR. I'm Eric Scott. We're talking with State Senator Jeb Bradley. I do have one question before I kind of go on. I've heard the expression all my life, but I have no idea what it is. What are whips as far as majority and minority whips? What do they do?
A whip, I mean, it's not the nicest term because, you know, a whip is obviously something that inflicts, you know, harm and hurt on people.
Right.
But the term in politics is that you whip your members of your caucus into line. And whipping is really not the way it works, okay? There's at least the time that all of the bodies I've served in, the New Hampshire House, the U.S. House, and now the New Hampshire Senate, you know, leadership of all three of those bodies on a, you know, a vote where there was some controversy about it and they were trying to take a count to know where they were at, you know, they would come to you and they'd say, where are you on whatever the issue is? And that would be, like when I was in Congress, that would be the whip or the whip team. And so there, Eric Cantor was the whip, you know, when I was in Congress, and he had a team of about 10 people and or more, maybe, I can't even remember, but they were responsible on any given day if there was a controversial vote, calling up their group of people. Are you a yes or are you a no? And depending on what the leadership wanted for a vote, you know, if you answered in a way that might have been against leadership, you might get another call. Why are you voting this way? And have you thought about this? And, you know, I mean, I never, when I was in Congress, I thought I was pretty independent minded. And if there was something that I felt I couldn't support, I didn't. And that didn't mean I didn't get a phone call from, you know, Eric Cantor or even Roy Blunt. But, you know, their rule of thumb was, you know, if you had a reasonable explanation as to why you were voting the way you were, whether it's, you know, how it affects your state, your personal beliefs, you know, whatever, you know, they didn't break your arm. And certainly, you know, now that I am in the New Hampshire Senate and the majority leader again, you know, that's how I operate. I mean, you know, you try to express the view of the caucus on an issue, but if somebody has a problem with that, They're going to vote the way they're going to vote. I encourage that. And doesn't mean, you know, we don't, as a caucus, have a conversation about it. And sometimes, you know, what one member of the of our caucus, and it's 14 of us now, sometimes they have for information that we hadn't thought about as a caucus. And it's important to, you know, debate it and have everybody have a voice, because sometimes it's like, okay, we hadn't thought about that. Maybe we want to go in a somewhat different direction, or maybe a bill needs an amendment, or, you know, any number of things. So I think the way that both myself and Senator Morse try to operate is we try to operate collaboratively, and everybody's, you know, voice is equally as important. And, you know, there on any given day, there are going to be members that of our side that don't agree with us. And, you know, they have to vote the way they have to vote. And there's no problem with that.
So there aren't any political consequences to defying House or Senate leadership?
You know, we've never operated like that in the New Hampshire Senate.
Nope. Okay.
Now, I mean, I think if, you know, when I was in Congress, I mean, look, most of the time I was a Republican. So, of course, and, you know, somebody that's a fiscal conservative and a conservative, too. And so, generally speaking, there wasn't much debate in my mind. But there were some issues that I saw it differently. I mean, for instance, you know, 15 years ago, MTBE was a big pollutant in groundwater.
Oh, the stuff that was in gasoline, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It was affecting the groundwater of New Hampshire, and we were one of the most affected states. And so, you know, I mean, there were bills that dealt with energy. And if they didn't, you know, if there was, like, ignoring the problems of MTBE, I couldn't vote for that. And I made it really clear to them, I'm sorry, I can't vote for it. And, you know, they said, okay. And, you know, that was that.
All right. It's WASR 1215. Thank you very much for listening on a very sunny but a bit chilly Friday afternoon. And State Senator Jeb Bradley is our guest today. What's going on with the broadband bill? I'm hearing that some towns are overbuilding, which is kind of nice. Laconia, Rochester, I believe, and hopefully some more as towns realize the importance of competition. But anyway, how is that? Because there are a lot of areas, like in my home, I have a choice between the cable company and the much slower DSL technology. That's it.
Yeah, and so at least you do have access to broadband.
Yes,
and,
I do.
And look, I think the majority of New Hampshire residents have access to broadband, and it may be, you know, depending on where you are, you know, it might be 10 to 15, maybe as high as 20% of New Hampshire does not have good access.
Is it that high, really?
I don't think it is that high. I think it's probably more like in the range of 10%. That's okay. What, you know, Wolfboro, I think because of the efforts of Paul O'Brien, that number is, you know, the penetration's about 95% and improving because Paul has done just an excellent job. Now, other towns, the town of Sandwich has almost no broadband. And, you know, so it's even if it's only 5% of the people in New Hampshire that don't have access to good broadband, that's still, in this day and age, it'd be like saying, yeah, well, you don't have access to electricity. I mean, you can't, if you choose to live without electricity, that's one thing, but it's not acceptable. It's so important, and broadband is, you know, that way, and as was telephone until the advent of technology and cell phone. But, you know, the pandemic has shown the importance of it for education, because kids aren't in school. In some places, telemedicine is really important so that people can avoid, you know, going to see their doctor and going into the hospital or whatever in a compromising situation in the pandemic, you know, just being able to work from home, being able to stay in touch with friends and family through the pandemic. I mean, it is increasingly important in all of our lives. And so my bill, I signed off on it last week. It was one of the last ones out of, you know, the drafting office. They're going to need to probably be a couple of changes made to it, amending it in the committee process. I didn't actually put a dollar amount for New Hampshire general funds to go into it. So that's something, you know, I'm going to work with the finance committee on. I think it remains to be seen, you know, what kind of federal dollars come in specifically for broadband or specifically for unencumbered funds for a state like New Hampshire to be able to use in a purpose like this. Those are questions still. I think the way it was drafted did not include the mapping and planning for reimbursement with the funding. I think that needs to be corrected because, you know, Carroll County Broadband, and I was talking to people from Grafton County yesterday, that's even further behind Carroll County in terms of knowing accurately where the problems are, what streets, you know, need wires run down. So that's a process that has to happen, obviously, before you can start stringing wires. And I think that that should be covered under a matching grant program. So I am going to have to fix that. But, you know, I thought it was important to get the bill signed, get it into the queue for a hearing because it's a priority bill. And my expectation is we're going to fold it into the Senate version of the budget when that happens.
Okay.
But there's still, you know, there's still miles to go before we sleep on that one.
Right. The other question, or the other side of this equation is how people access the Internet once they have it. Flagship phones, as you know, are well north of $1,000. Granted, you can buy a phone for a whole lot less than that. And there are payment plans that make the sting a lot less. But a lot of times, a lot of cities and towns can't afford to issue Chromebooks or other laptops. How do you tell a parent, which would most likely but not always be a single parent, that you know, their child needs a $350 computer and they don't have it?
Yeah, and I mean, that obviously is an issue. My bill just addresses getting the service to one's home. You know, schools, I think, have, you know, provided laptops for students in some instances, but then again, not every school has the ability to do that. So, you know, the way my approach is going to be one step at a time and try to get the service to people's homes.
Craig, you had said about 5% of New Hampshire. What does that work out to, about 30,000 people-ish?
Well,
25,
there's about 1.3 million residents in New Hampshire. So 10% of that would be 130,000 people. Right. Then divide that up again into, you know, maybe a three-unit household. So you're probably in the range of, you know, it could be 30 to 50,000, maybe more, maybe less. I don't know, you know, what those numbers work out to. But it's enough people that this is, you know, really got to be a priority.
Right. It is kind of amazing in this day and age that there are some people that don't have access to it. It's no longer really a luxury.
No, it's not a luxury. And you know, look, the way that we brought electric service and then phone service, you know, to people's households were through regulated monopolies that basically spread the cost out of, you know, rural electrification or, you know, phone service over the entire base of their customers. They were regulated by public utilities commissions around the country in each state. And that became a cost of doing business because it was deemed a societal need that people had access to phone and electricity. Broadband has developed, and I think it has been a good thing that it's developed in a different fashion, that, you know, cable companies in particular, and they're the larger purveyors of broadband at this point, you know, have negotiated contracts with individual towns, and so you have a free market, you know, response. And so, you know, when towns and select boards negotiate those contracts, they have to balance, you know, the cost of the population that is easily served, 90%, say, just to pick a number, versus the cost of 100% service, which makes, you know, that cost go up significantly. And so most towns, you know, stopped at, you know, dirt roads that were a quarter of a mile or half a mile long. But there are a lot of people in New Hampshire that live on dirt roads and that don't have broadband service as a result of that. And while, you know, it's possible that satellite broadband is, you know, in the foreseeable future, it hasn't happened yet. And that's why I think we need to, you know, use the resources that hopefully we have to, you know, get, you know, wires into people's homes so that they have access to it.
Well, satellite does exist. There are a couple of companies, but they are expensive. It's not very quick. And there are very low data caps.
And that, you know, that technology is likely to improve just as, you know.
Sure.
These technologies have improved. But
yeah, the big problem, though, is on satellite is the download cap. It's very, very low. A couple of HD movies and you've hit your cap. And then what do you do?
You know? Yeah, and one of the things that you know, has been pointed out to me is that the sort of norm now, 25 megabits or whatever it is, upload speed and 3 megabits download speed, you know, moving forward is probably not sufficient, that it, you know, should be more the 100-100 standard. But, you know, I think the important thing is to try to get service to as many people that need it as quickly as possible, so that, you know, the most types of services that people depend on can be offered.
Have you looked at
telemedicine, that kind of thing?
Which, it's funny, I just had my first televisit last week, and I'm like, hey, this is, you know, this might catch on. This is, this was all right. You don't have to go to the doctor and sit in the waiting room and read old magazines for half an hour, you know. It was kind of nice. But anyway, so has there been a discussion of what they call WISP technology, wireless internet service providers? Rather than satellite, it uses land-based radio towers to do basically the same thing and provide internet. There's a company in Boston that's starting it called Starry, while I don't know much about them, I know they exist.
And I don't know much about them either, Eric, but I would just add a cautionary note. If you go into the areas of New Hampshire that don't have broadband service that's readily available, many of those areas are going to have pretty limited cell phone service also.
Right.
It's just the nature of the beast. So the thought that we can go and avoid wire service to land-based wireless service, I'm not sure. I'm not an expert in it by any means, but I would just raise that cautionary flag that it may not be the answer that we're looking for.
It may not be. I just didn't know if, you know, you guys had looked into it and, you know, how practical it was, because the cost to build may be very, very high. And putting up towers is going to be very difficult.
And people have, you know, people have problems with towers all over the landscape. So, I mean, that's a reality, too.
Have you considered a? I know some areas have done it, not many, but almost like a having it as a public company. So let's say Carroll County Broadband Inc. And they would provide your broadband for much like Wolfboro Power and Light.
I'm not sure that that's the best idea. I mean, I don't think there's anything that precludes it, and I think we've in fact passed legislation that creates communication districts so that, you know, counties, if they wanted to, could get into, you know, the delivery of broadband. The electric cooperative in New Hampshire is now going to, be offering broadband service as they, you know, their board took a vote. And so that'll be an interesting sort of pilot program as to whether not that they're a regulated monopoly, because they have the ability to set their own rates. So they're somewhat outside of, you know, Eversource or the other, you know, investor-owned utilities that are regulated. And the reason for that is the cooperative is, you know, they don't answer to shareholders. They answer to members, and there's no profit. So in any case, you know, we'll see. We'll see if that works. I mean, for a town like Sandwich, I know they were incredibly happy that the co-op is going to be offering that kind of service. And so we'll see, you know, how that works out. I mean, to me, it's like, okay, it's another option. I think we need to pursue it. But the one thing I would say about the fact that we have not regulated, you know, wireless technology or even broadband technology in the way that we have, you know, electric and traditional phone, is that the free market, I think, has brought technological innovation, which has been extraordinarily helpful, you know, to all of us that can access it. Now the question is, how do we expand that access to, you know, people that it's been very expensive to get that service to? And I think, you know, that's why 25, 30 years ago, when cable became, you know, the norm, it was seen as a better way to do it, to have it a free market approach than, you know, a regulated monopoly. And I think that's the right thing, because I do think we've had, you know, better innovation. Prices have been, you know, better as a result of it, because there's competition. So,
sure. All right. Well, here's a interesting question. At one point, internet providers were classed as, and correct me if I'm wrong here, common carriers, which means they had to treat every piece of data the same. You couldn't favor one. You couldn't have one faster than the other. And somehow that changed a few years ago. And there are good things and bad things about it. For instance, AT&T says that you can watch DirecTV, which they own, on your phone without using your data charge. And hey, you know, fantastic. That's great if you know, if you're a big fan of watching TV on a 6-inch phone. But I'm not sure if we shouldn't go back to that. I mean, why should, you know, it's kind of like electricity. Voltage is voltage, and they deliver it to your house, and they don't, you know, they don't play around with it. Do you happen to know why somehow the regulations were changed?
So this is the whole debate about what's known as net neutrality.
That's it. That's the word I thought.
That every entity that wanted to put information out, you know, over the World Wide Web and on wires and things like that, had to have equal access to it. So the rationale behind why net neutrality may not be the best idea, and there is merit to it. I'm not saying there's no merit to it, but the countervailing point of view is that, again, the companies that are investing in stringing the wires and all of the infrastructure, you know, the backbone of the internet, have made their investment, and that has fostered technological innovation. So if you then suddenly treat their investment as a, you know, common carrier type of situation, I think you will see less innovation and less competition. And I think innovation and competition has driven, you know, what we're all able to do over the internet in a very positive way. So, you know, again, there's merit to net neutrality, but I think on balance, we're better off with, you know, innovation, competition, that type of thing.
Okay. You are listening to Jeb Bradley. He is our normal Friday guest here on WASR. And if you have a question, 569-5253. I know that you guys talked about vaccines quite a bit on Jack Heath's show a little bit earlier, about 11:30 this morning when we were broadcasting that show. But it's funny. I'll give you my situation, and maybe you can address it. There are certain people who qualify for the 1B because of various health issues. And, for instance, I've had some friends call me and say, oh, yeah, I have that. Okay, well, and it says you have to go to your doctor. The problem is you call your doctor, and they have no idea what's going on.
Okay, so the good news, and quite frankly, I think there is a lot of good news, even though the governor has said people are going to have to be patient. So,
and he's right.
Well, the reason why we're getting about 17,000 doses a week, when that gets bigger, it's going to get faster. Okay. And that's been our allocation, you know, so far. And I mean, even having this conversation a year or so after the pandemic started, that we now have a vaccine that, you know, people are getting vaccinated. And, you know, the health experts yesterday said that it would appear in New Hampshire, at least, our numbers are starting to come down again. And part of that reason, especially in, you know, assisted living and long-term care facilities, part of that reason appears to be the vaccine. So the governor a week ago opened it up in phase 1B to anyone that is 65 and older, or if you're younger than 65 and you have co-occurring conditions like heart or cancer or COPD, things like that, you would, as long as you have a note from your doctor, you would also be able to get into that category now. So I texted with the governor this morning because the website went live at 8 a.m. today, Friday. And he told me that 70,000 people had registered in the first hour.
Wow.
And for anybody that needs that link, it's www.nh.gov/COVID-19. Okay? So go to that website, and it's relatively easy to hit the appropriate link. You have to fill in the information that's asked of you, and then after the registration process is complete, it takes a few minutes. Anybody that successfully registered will get an email from the Department of Health and Human Services within the next 3 to 5 days. If you don't see it, you should check your spam folder, okay? Because we all should be getting them if anybody that's registered. So then, once you get that email, you can make an appointment, basically. And I'm sure that, you know, those appointments are going to go fairly quickly. You know, especially, you know, the fact that my recollection is that in phase 1B, there are about 100,000 people in New Hampshire, maybe a little bit more than that, that are eligible on top of phase 1A. Phase 1A was frontline healthcare workers, first responders, and people that were residents and staff of assisted living and long-term care facilities. So now it's expanded to, you know, people that are 65 and older. So it's going to take a few weeks to work through that phase. And then the next phase will be people between the ages of 50 and 64. And then, you know, a couple of months from now, it should be, depending on what the vaccine supply is, open to anybody that wants a vaccination. Now, I suspect that in the federal stimulus bills that keep getting talked about, that one of the things that's going to get absolute bipartisan support will be new resources for, you know, trying to speed up as much as possible the production. The other thing that should be realized is that there are two other companies' vaccines that are in the approval pipeline, Johnson & Johnson, which is a one-shot vaccine, and then AstraZeneca, I believe, is the fourth vaccine. So a couple of months from now, there could be significantly more supply, which will hasten the process of getting, you know, people vaccinated. So again, that website is www.nh.gov COVID-19.
Okay. nh.gov/COVID-19.
All right. That's correct.
All right. You can register there. And by the way, a tribute to the people that built and maintained that website, that 70,000 people registered in an hour and the site didn't crash.
Yeah. So there was some, you know, a lot of discussion about that, obviously. And you know what? I made a mistake in the website. It's actually www.nh.gov/COVID-19. Okay?
Right. I knew
I
that.
I forgot the slash.
That's what, so I anyway, put it in there
yes,
for you.
The website seems to be working, you know, pretty well. So I'm going to go on it right now and see if I can, you know, just check in the registration.
Yeah, I went on earlier this morning, and it came up just fine.
Yep. So I think probably the first rush was, you know, a little bit tough, but I would expect that the, you know, as we're several hours into it, it goes, you know, gets a little easier. The other thing, because not everybody has a computer or it's easy to use, so people can also dial the helpline 211, and you know, there are people that will answer questions. I'm told that the helpline is being staffed by members of the New Hampshire National Guard, and I'm told that they're very capable and doing a really good job.
Yeah, I've heard that they went through training some time ago, and if I remember right, I think the governor said there were about 300 new people answering 211 calls, which I think is fantastic. So also, if you have a friend or relative that you trust that knows how to use a computer or has a computer, they can register you as well with their email address.
That's correct. And then, like
for instance, with my, you know, my mother is quite elderly, and all her bills and things come to me and my email. So she does, because she doesn't own a computer. So, like I said, if you know, if that's if using a computer or you're not comfortable with it, ask your kid. I'm sure they'll be happy to do it for you. It is 12:41. It's WASR. Jeb Bradley is my guest today. We were talking earlier here at the radio station before air about whether about pent-up demand for things. And we think that if this vaccine rolls out as hopefully we think it will, we could have a better-than-average summer because a lot of people didn't come here because they weren't able to. I was curious what you thought of that and what the general consensus might be with your colleagues?
So, look, I think that, you know, and I've said this many times before, but I think it bears repeating. Governor Sununu has done an excellent job of managing both the public health / COVID-19 crisis and trying to keep the New Hampshire economy as open as possible with, you know, protections in place like masking and social distancing. That's been a balancing act. You know, where we're going to be on Memorial Day, which is sort of the official start of summer, I think it's a bit up in the air. But if the most vulnerable people in our state and in our country, and the science is saying that they're people that are over 70, in particular people over 70 that may have, you know, a couple of co-occurring conditions, and if, you know, those folks are getting vaccinated, everybody that wants a vaccine, and by that point in time we're also below 50 in terms of people getting vaccinated, and the efficacy of the vaccine is, as you know, the clinical trials showed, I think we're going to be a long ways into, you know, a recovery. We just, you know, I mean, that's the hopeful and optimistic outlook. And I think that's realistic at this point. I think we'll see, you know, as I said before, AstraZeneca and Johnson & Johnson vaccines, hopefully on the market shortly. That'll increase the supply even further. You know, some states are having rollout issues. I think they're going to resolve themselves as, you know, just, you know, as hospital capacity had to be resolved, you know, in the April, May timeline of 2020. Now, even though, like, for instance, we have about 250 people hospitalized in New Hampshire, our hospitals are doing a pretty darn good job of managing it. And I think, again, this goes back to, you know, Governor Sununu's leadership, you know, and having focused effectively on public health and keeping, you know, things open. I think New Hampshire is poised for a pretty good summer.
Well, here's an interesting question. Current unemployment rate in New Hampshire is in the fours.
I think it's, unless it's gone up in the last couple of weeks, I think it's 3.6%.
Okay, it's that low. Okay, 3.6. And I've been told by more than one person that, quote, full employment is roughly a 5% unemployment rate. But yet we're spending extra money on unemployment insurance and things like that. And again, that, to me, that comes back to a disincentive to work. And that's not something people who know me well think I would say. But it's, you know, I don't understand it. I mean, 3.4% jobs are going begging. Why are we, you know, spending more money on unemployment insurance?
Well, the way that unemployment has been structured as a result of COVID, you know, for instance, if you're a parent with a couple of kids and your kids aren't able to go back to school because it's remote learning, you know, it is far more excuse-free unemployment than it has been in the past. If you're self-employed, but you're unable to work for any number of reasons that are COVID-related, you're eligible for unemployment. So I think, you know, we need to continue to, you know, take care of people that, but for unemployment, would have, you know, had some significant problems. And I mean, I have people calling me up. It's sort of tapered off now, but boy, for, you know, from April through even August, I had, you know, hundreds of calls from people to try to sort out their unemployment issues. And I have to say that the folks at the Department of Employment Security in New Hampshire who run the unemployment program were nothing more than terrific and, you know, trying to help people because it was complicated. You know, they had, you know, to repeat, apply every Sunday. if you were self-employed, that was, you know, something that was new and different because we haven't made those folks eligible. Now, to get back to your question, I think a stimulus bill is going to have more money for unemployment in it federally. Not every state is as fortunate as New Hampshire. And we've seen a lot of other states, New York, California, New Jersey, Michigan, that have had much, much stricter, you know, guidelines in terms of businesses reopening. And they really haven't had, you know, better health outcomes, but they have had worse economic outcomes. And so I think it would be difficult to, you know, for people in those states to, you know, not have unemployment. And I think it's still difficult for some people in New Hampshire. So, you know, I think we're going to have to ride it out. Hopefully, whatever, you know, stimulus package emerges from Washington doesn't create a disincentive to work. And there's no question that, you know, the $600 extra a week federal stipend that was passed in that first CARES Act in March, when we didn't know as much as we know today, over time created a disincentive to work. Now, I think, you know, the hospitality industry, for instance, restaurants, you know, was able to operate to some extent, some better than others, through the summer when the weather was good and they could have outdoor seating and people, you know, were, you know, willing to patronize restaurants. Right now, I don't think restaurants are probably doing too well, not because of Governor Sununu's actions, but just because I think people are aware that, you know, they're putting themselves in a situation that offers less protection. And with COVID cases spiking, I think people have been unwilling to, you know, go back to, you know, their favorite restaurant. That's understandable. So, you know, people that are, you know, wait staff and people that work in restaurants have been really adversely affected, you know, by this. And hopefully as more people are getting vaccinated, as the weather gets better and we can resume some of the outdoor seating again, but trying to make sure that those businesses survive and those employees survive, unemployment's a pretty important part of that.
And one of the things that has helped restaurants are these food delivery services, DoorDash, Grubhub, and things like that. Now, they're not here in Wolfboro, but they are in parts of the Lakes region, including my home, and I have used it quite a few times already. It is very convenient. It's a great way to help your local restaurant. And if, you know, if you're interested, get a hold of these, you know, these folks at Grubhub or DoorDash or Postmates or any of the other and say, look, you know, I want the service too. And it's a gig, you know, job. It's a pretty good job. You just go and pick up food, just like when you deliver pizza. Only it shows, you know, you have a list of all of these restaurants that shows up at your door. I'm sure restaurant owners have found that to be a good thing.
Yeah, I mean, I think hopefully restaurants can survive with takeout.
I hope
some
so.
Will do better than others, obviously. You know, hopefully we are seeing the beginning of the end. And I think, you know, as the vaccine takes hold and we continue, you know, for the next few months of social distancing, and a stimulus bill is targeted toward individuals and businesses that need it the most, we'll see our way through this.
Yeah, I know we'll get there eventually. I think a lot of fear is the fear of the unknown. You know, I've always kind of believed that that's the worst. I think that's the worst fear you can have is, you know, the unknown. You don't know what's going to happen. Now, in our remaining minutes, I do want to ask you a little bit about that CARES Act package, almost $2 trillion, which puts our national deficit somewhere around $30 trillion-ish. I mean, give or take a couple of bucks, right? What's a trillion here or there? this is not sustainable. You know more about it, of course, than I do. Is there absolutely no one who seems to care about that debt number at this point?
You know, I think that, you know, we're in a crisis and we have to deal with the crisis at hand. That being said, that's why I think people in Washington, on my side of the aisle, quite frankly, have balked at some of the free-for-all spending that, you know, has been proposed by Speaker Pelosi in particular. I hope that, you know, President Biden's $1.9 trillion plan, I think it probably can be slimmed down some and targeted more appropriately. And I think, you know, if there's bipartisan cooperation, then, you know, there's a, you know, a chance to make that happen. We'll see. But $30 trillion is a staggering number.
Yeah, it's kind of hard to imagine. I mean, I can't even imagine the guy who won the Powerball was 700 and something million. You know, $30 trillion is, I think, beyond my understanding.
And you know what? I mean, this is a Republican problem, and it's a Democrat problem.
Right.
You know, and it's, I'll just say this. When I left Washington after I lost in 2006, the economy was strong. The national unemployment rate was 4.4%. The federal deficit on a yearly basis was down in the range of $150 billion, still too high. But we are just, you know, in terms of our regular expenditures, and 60 to 63% of that is Medicare, Medicaid, and, you know, interest on the national debt and Social Security. They're all on autopilot, basically. And all the rest, you know, which is everything else, we argue over. We're running deficits of close to $1 trillion right now, too. You know, Congress has got a tough job. And so, you know, one side says, well, just raise taxes. You raise taxes, you cut economic growth. In all likelihood, you reduce revenue. You don't raise taxes and the economy doesn't expand enough, you're running deficits. I mean, so I think, you know, we are going to have to look at how we deal with these entitlement programs, Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. And in particular, the two that are age eligible, Medicare and Social Security, as people are living longer gradually, and I mean really gradually, ramping up the eligibility age, I think is something that needs to be considered.
No, I agree. In fact, they've already started it. My retirement age is 67 and four.
Yeah,
months.
As is mine.
Yeah.
I was not eligible for Social Security until I reached 67. I was eligible for Medicare once I reached 65. So, you know, I think that if you added a month or two every year to the age of eligibility for Medicare and Social Security, over time, and this is how these programs work, actuarially, we would start to turn them around. And, you know, I think that we've got to confront it.
Well, I agree. I also think, personally, that we need to raise the cap on the Social Security tax.
And you know what? That may be part of a bipartisan agreement. You know, I mean, it's been proposed in the past. It is going up at the rate of inflation.
Right.
So, you know, depending, you know, we haven't had significant inflation for some time, so it hasn't gone up that much, but it does go up. I want to make sure that, you know, correct any misinterpretation right. of that.
My only problem with the whole thing is, you know, you don't end up, you don't know where interest rates are going to go. You know, if interest rates spike, we could be in a world of hurt.
Yeah, we would we'd be in a world of hurt. one crisis would turn into another.
Yeah, I remember when I bought my first car and I got the prime rate, 18%. I think that was 1982 when they were trying to break inflation's back from the 70s, which yeah. did work, by the way. It was painful, but it worked. I don't know. I mean, if the Fed keeps interest rates low and the 10-year Treasury return is under 1%, I don't know about you, but I'm not going to buy 10-year Treasuries with a interest rate that low. I can get that at my bank.
Well, especially with the stock market going where it's going. But, Eric, I'm going to have to sign off. I have a 1 o'clock Zoom meeting
I understand.
I have to be on, and so I need to sign into that. And I look forward to talking to you next week.
Great. All right, Senator, thank you very much for your time. Again, it's much appreciated.
Okay.
Take care of yourself. That's Senator Jeb Bradley on WASR, our regular Friday guest. He is on every afternoon, or every Friday afternoon, I should say, from noon to one here at WASR. It is 12:59. News is next. And don't forget, by the way, if you're a sports fan, later this afternoon, it's Mike and the Hoss, 4:30 to 5:30, right here live on WASR. They're on Tuesdays and Fridays now, so they can look at the weekend coming up in this show, and then on Tuesday, they can kind of look at what happened on Monday night and the previous weekend. So I think you'll like the show if you haven't heard it yet. Mike and the Hoss, 4:30 today on WASR.